ocean to kill us all, she thought. But there's nothing strange about that. It could happen any time. It has nothing to do with the war. It could happen to anyone, anywhere. Everybody thinks it's happening because of the war, but that's not true. The war is just one of the things that could happen. Face to face with the submarine and its huge gun, Nutmeg felt no fear. Her mother was shouting at her, but the words made no sense. Then she felt something grab her wrists and pull on them. But her hands stayed locked on the rail. The roar of voices all around her began to move far away, as if someone were turning down the volume on a radio. I'm so sleepy, she thought. So sleepy. Why am I so sleepy? She closed her eyes, and her consciousness rushed away, leaving the deck far behind. Nutmeg was seeing Japanese soldiers as they moved through the extensive zoo, shooting any animal that could attack human beings. The officer gave his order, and the bullets from the Model 38 rifles ripped through the smooth hide of a tiger, tearing at the animal's guts. The summer sky was blue, and from the surrounding trees, the screams of cicadas rained down like a sudden shower. The soldiers never spoke. The blood was gone from their sunburned faces, which made them look like pictures painted on ancient urns. A few days from now, a week at most, the main force of the Soviet Far East Command would arrive in Xinjiang. There was no way to stop the advance. Ever since the war began, the crack troops and once abundant equipment of the Kwantung Army had been drained away to support the widening southern front, and now the greater part of both had sunk to the bottom of the sea or was rotting in the depths of the jungle. The tanks were gone. The anti-tank guns were gone. All but a handful of the troop transport trucks had broken down, and there were no spare parts. A general mobilization could still bring together large numbers of troops, but there were not even enough old model rifles left to arm every man, or bullets enough to load every rifle. And so the great Kwantung Army, bulwark of the North, had been reduced to a paper tiger. The proud Soviet mechanized units that had crushed the German army were completing their transfer by rail to the far eastern front, with plenty of equipment and with spirits high. The collapse of Manchukuo was imminent. Everyone knew this to be the truth, the Kwantung Army Command most of all. And so they evacuated their main force to the rear, in effect abandoning both the small border garrisons and the Japanese civilian smallholders. These unarmed farmers were slaughtered by the Soviet army, which was advancing too rapidly to take prisoners. Many women chose, or were forced to choose, mass suicide over rape. The border garrisons locked themselves into the concrete bunker dubbed Fortress for the Ages and put up a fierce resistance, but without support from the rear, they were annihilated by the Soviets' overwhelming firepower. Members of the general staff and other high-ranking officers arranged to have themselves transferred to new headquarters in Tonghua near the Korean border. And the puppet emperor Henry Puyi and his family threw their possessions together and escaped from the capital by private train. Most of the Chinese soldiers in the Manchukuo army, assigned to defend the capital, deserted as soon as they heard the Soviets were invading, or else they staged revolts and shot their Japanese commanding officers. They had no intention of laying down their lives for Japan in a struggle against superior Soviet troops. As a result of these interrelated developments, the capital city of Manchukuo, the special new capital city Xinjiang, which the modern Japanese state had constructed in the wilderness and staked its reputation on, was left floating in a strange political vacuum. In order to avoid needless chaos and bloodshed, the high-ranking Chinese bureaucrats of Manchukuo argued that Xinjiang should be declared an open city and surrendered without armed resistance. But the Kwantung army rejected this. The soldiers dispatched to the zoo had resigned themselves to their fate. In a mere few days, they assumed they would die fighting the Soviet army, though in fact, after disarmament, they would be sent to work, and in the case of three of the men, to die in Siberian coal mines. All they could do was pray that their deaths would not be too painful. None of them wanted to be crushed under the tracks of a slow-moving tank, or roasted in a trench by flamethrowers, or die by degrees with a bullet in the stomach. Better to be shot in the head or the heart. But first, they had to kill these zoo animals. If possible, they were to kill the animals with poison in order to conserve what few bullets they had left.